Chapter 8. Marilyn Monroe, John F. Kennedy, and Dorothy Kilgallen, three powerful personalities of the early 1960s, each strongly impacted the worlds of entertainment, politics, and the media. When attempting to better understand what their states of mind were at the time, both personally and professionally, from 1962 through 1965 and even before, one must attempt to uncover the truth and separate, as noted, fact from fiction. In an attempt to do so, one must probe beneath the superficial accounts of why each of them died at such a young age and who may have been responsible for their early demise. Since Marilyn died first, in August 1962, closer inspection of the events of her life and times not included in her book My Story is a priority. Fortunately, a special portrait of the human side of Marilyn is possible through the book Fragments, Poems, Intimate Notes, Letters by Marilyn Monroe, published in 2010. Edited by Stanley Buchtal and Bernard Comment, this important reference book is based on the personal possessions that were bequeathed to Lee Strasberg, the Polish-born American actor, director, and theater practitioner when Marilyn died. After his passing, his widow, Anna, permitted the editors access to Marilyn's writings and photos, triggering publication of the book. The writings reveal the personal Marilyn, full of ideas and perspectives on life, permitting an inside look at who she really was, not the alleged wayward, barbiturate-infected movie star who allegedly committed suicide. This is primary source material of the best kind, since the writings are in her hand, each packed with emotion. Along with My Story, Fragments is a must-read as well for anyone desiring to know the true Marilyn. Marilyn's love for books became obvious to anyone who truly knew her. There seems little doubt the many photos taken of her reading were designed to erase the idea that she was a dumb blonde. Among her personal effects are photos of her reading books by Heinrich Heine, various poems, James Joyce, Ulysses, Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass, and, of course, Arthur Miller, who she sometimes called Art, Death of a Salesman, as well as Hemingway, Beckett, and Kerouac. If anyone wants to dispute the intellectual side of Marilyn, try reading Ulysses. Unbeknownst to many, Marilyn was also a prolific writer, whether it was scratching out notes on hotel stationery, Waldorf Astoria, Beverly Hills Hotel, Hotel Bel Air, and Parkside House in Surrey, England, or even on one occasion, City Title Insurance Company stationery. Reading these notes offers a true window into Marilyn's mind and her scattered thoughts on a day-to-day basis. Marilyn, who sometimes used the nifty pseudonym Zelda Zonk when she was trying to hide her identity on trips between New York City and Los Angeles, also read books on the craft of acting, such as To the Actor by Michael Chekhov. She also developed an interest in such classic European artists as Botticelli, Goya, and Degas. She visited the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where she sat and enjoyed Rodin's Hand of God sculpture. Marilyn's accomplishments as a poet count as even more surprising to those who only think of Marilyn the actress, the one who supposedly took her life. In the Fragments collection, Marilyn's intellect and talent as a wordsmith shine through. Certainly, scattered thoughts about a variety of subjects ring true, but when she focuses on a particular set of thoughts, the verses are clear, purposeful, and many times heartwarming. One poem in particular reveals an interesting side of Marilyn, especially the line, "strong as a cobweb in the wind," indicating a resolve many questioned during her life. She writes, "Life, I am both of your directions, somehow remaining hanging downward the most, but strong as a cobweb in the wind. I exist more with cold glistening frost, but my beaded rays have the colors I've seen in a painting. Ah, life, they have cheated you." Another read, "Only parts of us will ever touch parts of others. One's own truth is just that, really, one's own truth. We can only share the part that is within another's knowing acceptable, so one is, for the most part, alone." and it is meant to be, evidently, in nature. At best, perhaps it could make our understanding seek another's loneliness out. In one of Marilyn's possessions that the editors called her Record Black Notebook, around 1951, Marilyn wrote, "Alone. I am alone. I am always alone, no matter what," before adding, "What do I believe in? What is truth? I believe in myself, even my most delicate, intangible feelings. In the end, everything is intangible. My most precious liquid must never spill. Don't spill your precious liquid. Life force. They are all my feelings, no matter what. My feeling doesn't happen to swell into words." On Waldorf Astoria stationery, Marilyn addressed her acting craft in 1955 while taking classes in hopes of becoming part of Lee Strasberg's actor's studio. She wrote, "Not a scared, lonely little girl anymore. Too much talent, too much ability, and much too much sensitivity to invert yourself out of fear. Not come to class, or to do things like being to come to class or to get up." In another notebook, Marilyn indicated her insecurity, apparently based on others' warnings about appearing with famed broadcaster Edward R. Murrow on his popular show Person to Person. As noted, Kilgallen was a guest as well. Marilyn wrote, "I'm not permitted to be on Edward R. Murrow's show. Problems, nervousness, humanness, blunders, mistakes, and my own thoughts." Despite the misgivings of others, and perhaps some trepidation of her own, she did appear, as noted, for a Murrow interview on April 8, 1955. Marilyn certainly displayed her humor in various writings for which the dates are not known. In Marilyn Among Friends, Norman Rostin, a close friend of the movie star, wrote, "She gave herself pretty names. One day she signed a note with Noodle, Sam, Max, Clump, Sugar Finney, Pussy, and so on. She had a great sense of humor." The pretty names Rostin spoke of are mentioned in her writings in Fragments. Perhaps the most important of Marilyn's writings, as preserved in Fragments, are written answers she gave to an interviewer who, unfortunately, remains unknown. The famous movie star did not generally like interviews and, on most occasions, asked for the questions ahead of time. In this instance, the answers without the questions still provide insight into Marilyn's psyche at the time on many subjects of interest. The answers read in part, "There was a pupil-teacher relationship at the beginning of the marriage, and I learned a great deal from it. A good marriage is a very delicate balance of many forces, but there was much more to the marriage than that," apparently a question about her marriage to Arthur Miller. "The love of my work and a few reliable human beings, the hope of my future growth and development, I am at ease with people I trust or admire or like. The rest I am not at ease with. I love poetry and poets. I have great feeling for all the persecuted ones in the world. The lack of consistent love and caring, a mistrust and fear of the world was the result," apparently about her childhood. In addition to Fragments, the recollections of Marilyn's niece, Mona Miracle, regarding Marilyn at an early age and beyond are of special interest. In August 2012, the 50th anniversary of Marilyn's death, Mona provided insight during an interview with the United Kingdom's Daily Mirror. Among other revelations, she stated, "I was 5 when we met. I remember she smelled good and gave me lots of hugs when we went to the station in Detroit to meet her." Mona added, "She was tons of fun. She could really appreciate a good joke. She was a prankster. One time she came to visit and I said, 'I want to be pretty like you.' So she painted my fingernails with her scarlet nail polish." Mona also told the interviewer, "Marilyn certainly wasn't the dumb blonde she was made out to be. She was intelligent and loved reading." Regarding Marilyn's hair color, Mona recalled, "I said to her, 'Aunt Norma Jean, your hair is blonde now.' She told me the head of her modeling agency had told her she should do it because blonde hair looked good in any light." Mona recalled that her aunt had sent along the dress she wore when she married Jim Doherty. Mona described it as just beautiful, a white ballerina-length dress. When Mona asked for advice about boys, she said Marilyn told her, "Just be yourself, don't pretend." Regarding Joe DiMaggio, Mona told the interviewer, "I know she was planning on remarrying Joe. He was really the love of her life. They knew what they wanted out of life at that point, and they could have made it work. It's so sad she never became a mother. She would have been wonderful." When it comes to arguably the most likely scenario as to the final hours of Marilyn's life on Earth, it's important to bypass many of the accounts included in books written years after she died. Some parts of those accounts may be factual, but too often authors have relied on speculation in order to tell the story they want to tell, which relies on information passed from one person to another, hearsay testimony, inadmissible in a court of law, and more gossip and rumor than anything else. With this in mind, books written close to when Marilyn died offer more preferable accounts than those written decades later. One book above all the others appears to provide the truth about what happened to Marilyn, The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe by Frank A. Capel, published in 1964, just 2 years after her tragic death, with a bright red cover. More about Capel's book will be addressed later regarding those he believed were involved with her death, but for the purposes of learning the truth about what was happening in her life just prior to August 4, 1962, the following must be strongly considered. Much of the information he provides is based on Los Angeles newspaper stories and in-depth research, including interviews with many of the major players who knew Marilyn well. Part of Capel's account includes, "Marilyn came under the influence of a Beverly Hills psychiatrist, Dr. Ralph R. Greenson. He is a relative or very close friend of Marilyn's lawyer, Milton A. Mickey Rudin, also a lawyer for Elizabeth Taylor. Head shrinker Greenson was charging Marilyn $50 per visit, $425 today, and his bill from July 1, 1962 to August 4, 1962 was $1,400, nearly $12,000 in today's currency. Greenson's statements to the press were that he was getting Marilyn off the use of barbiturates. It must have nullified his efforts, however, when a physician friend of his who was treating Marilyn kept prescribing barbiturates for her. The physician was Dr. Hyman Engelberg, who pronounced Marilyn dead at 3:45 a.m. on Sunday, August 4, 1962, and signed her death certificate. The day before Marilyn died, the two doctors were very busy with Marilyn, according to their sworn affidavits supporting their claims for fees filed in the Superior Court. Dr. Greenson shows that he treated Marilyn at his office on Friday, August 3rd, for at least 1.5 hours. Dr. Engelberg shows that he visited Marilyn on the same day at her home, for which he charged $25. He also swore he gave her an injection of some sort for which he charged $10 extra. In spite of her visits to and from doctors, Marilyn felt up to ordering fine liquors and food delicacies from Briggs & Company of 13,038 San Vicente Boulevard, Los Angeles, the bill totaling $49.07. Regarding the accuracy of Capel's disclosures, of importance is that he personally took the time to check court records, as well as visit or contact Briggs & Company, where Marilyn had ordered the liquors and food delicacies. Such on-the-job efforts appear to dictate a first-rate investigation by the author. Regarding the question of the amount of drugs Marilyn possessed on the day of her death, Capel wrote, "Dr. Greenson gave Marilyn a prescription of 25 capsules of Phenergan in 25 milligram strength. This is an antihistamine drug often used for allergy. He also gave her a prescription of 25 Nembutal capsules in 1 1/2 grain strength. The prescriptions were dated August 3, 1962, and were filled by the Vincenti Pharmacy, 12025 San Vicente Boulevard, Los Angeles. They assigned number 20,857 to the Phenergan prescription and number 20,858 to the Nembutal prescription. Based on this information, Capel added, Dr. Engelberg told the police on August 5th, and their report shows that he had prescribed a refill of Nembutal about 2 days ago, and that there should have been about 50 capsules at the time of the refill. This is completely false. The prescription was dated August 3, 1962, and it called for only 25 capsules. It was not a refill since it was given a new number. More about Dr. Greenson and Dr. Engelberg follows, but the homework author Capel did appears to be outstanding. He followed the trail of the prescriptions to the extent of visiting or contacting the pharmacy regarding the specific drugs involved, the number assigned to them, and so forth. How he was able to obtain what would have been private information is unknown, but he obviously did so. What is also impressive is Capel's quoting primary sources, official documents, and so forth. This certainly would have impressed Dorothy Kilgallen, since she was always searching for the truth based on the best, most credible sources available. To that end, Capel even included in his book a letter from Dr. Greenson to Marilyn's attorney's office after her death, itemizing the bill for professional services which I sent to the estate of Marilyn Monroe for the sum of $1,400. Regarding the movements of those people close to Marilyn who were around her home just before she died, Capel shines again, since these accounts are based on research apparently conducted very soon after Marilyn's death. He began by dealing with Pat Newcomb, whom he called Marilyn's close friend. Capel wrote that she told him, I had arrived at Marilyn's house Friday night after work. I was fighting a bad case of bronchitis and had decided to enter a hospital for a complete rest. But Marilyn had called me and said, Why don't you come out here? You can have all the privacy you want. You can have sun in the back, and you won't have to go to a hospital. When I arrived, I found her in wonderful spirits. She was in a good mood, a very happy mood. Capel then added his own comments. Miss Newcomb stated that part of Marilyn's happiness was due to the decision of 20th Century Fox to resume making the film Something's Got to Give, with their star back in the role. It also pleased Marilyn that her completed portions of the film were shown to studio executives in New York, and there was a great deal of excitement. Regarding Dr. Greenson, Capel wrote, He painted a different picture when he was questioned by police. The police report shows Dr. Greenson had seen the deceased on August 4, 1962, Saturday, at 5:15 p.m. at her request because she was unable to sleep. He had been treating her for about 1 year. Capel then commented, Why she would want to go to sleep at 5:15 p.m. in the afternoon, he did not say, nor would it seem logical for her to want to go to sleep since she had a guest, Pat Newcomb, with her. In explaining a bill of $1,400 submitted to Marilyn's estate for payment, Dr. Greenson had this to say, All office visits lasted a minimum of 1.5 hours. All visits to the home were approximately 2 hours in duration. Playing amateur sleuth, Capel then wrote, If we are to accept Dr. Greenson's story, he would have been trying to put Marilyn to sleep while she and Pat Newcomb were enjoying each other's company, and Marilyn was in a good mood, a happy mood, as stated by Miss Newcomb, who did not leave until 6:30 p.m., and makes no mention of seeing any psychiatrist trying to put Marilyn to sleep. The author added, To the contrary, Marilyn told Newcomb, I'll see you tomorrow, toodaloo. Addressing the hours before Marilyn died, Capel wrote, At 7 p.m., Marilyn reportedly talked on the telephone to Peter Lawford, who invited her to come to a dinner party. Filling in the blanks, Capel then added, quoting from the follow-up police report, According to the police report, Marilyn had retired at about 8 p.m. on Saturday, August 4, 1962. This information was given to them by Marilyn's housekeeper, Mrs. Eunice Murray. She stated she saw a light under the door in Marilyn's room at 12 midnight, but went to bed. At 3:30 a.m., she looked again and saw the light under the door. The door was locked, so she walked around and looked in the bedroom window. She said she saw Marilyn lying in bed on her stomach with the phone receiver in her hand. She stated she called Marilyn's psychiatrist, and he told her to call Dr. Engelberg, which she did. Dr. Greenson arrived at 3:40 a.m. He stated that he broke the window pane in the bedroom window. He entered through the window, removed the telephone from her hand, and found her probably dead. Rigor mortis had already set in. Continuing the chronology, Capel added, "About 10 minutes later, at 3:50 a.m., Dr. Engelberg arrived and pronounced her dead. She had already been dead for at least 3 to 6 hours. Finally, at 4:25 a.m., Dr. Engelberg called the police, who had a man on the scene in minutes. He was Sergeant Clemens, who in turn notified detectives, after which Sergeant Byron took charge of the investigation. The coroner's office was notified by 5:25 a.m. The coroner showed the time of death as 3:40 a.m., while the police, being uncertain, showed the time of death between 8 p.m. Saturday, August 4th, and 3:35 a.m. on August 5th. While others had padded these statements and documents with untruths to fit their specific theories as to what the hours were like before Marilyn's death, Capel, again, seems to get it right. More will follow about the author, his controversial background, and why government officials then and other so-called experts since disregard much of anything he reported when, in fact, that should never have happened. Capel ended his chronology by pointing out that by 10:30 a.m. Sunday, an autopsy had been performed by T. Noguchi, M.D., Deputy Medical Examiner, and a report was prepared, number 81128. The report's conclusion would forever be debated, forever be questioned. Regardless, 26 people were invited to Marilyn's funeral. John and Robert Kennedy, Peter and Pat Lawford, and perhaps more notably, Dr. Engelberg, were not invited by Joe DiMaggio, who was in charge. At the funeral, Lee Strasberg, who had worked with Marilyn regarding his renowned method acting skills, provided a heartwarming eulogy. In part, it read, "Marilyn Monroe was a legend. In her own lifetime, she created a myth of what a poor girl from a deprived background could attain. For the entire world, she became a symbol of the eternal feminine. But I have no words to describe the myth and the legend. I did not know this Marilyn Monroe. We gathered here today knew only Marilyn, a warm human being, impulsive and shy, sensitive and in fear of rejection, yet ever avid for life and reaching out for fulfillment. I will not insult the privacy of your memory of her, a privacy she sought and treasured, by trying to describe her whom you knew to you who knew her. In our memories of her, she remains alive, and not only a shadow on the screen or a glamorous personality. For us, Marilyn was a devoted and loyal friend, a colleague constantly reaching for perfection. We shared her pain and difficulties, and some of her joys. She was a member of our family. It is difficult to accept the fact that her zest for life has been ended by this dreadful accident." He added, "Despite the heights and brilliance she had attained on the screen, she was planning for the future. She was looking forward to participating in the many exciting things she planned. In her eyes and in mine, her career was just beginning. Others were as physically beautiful as she was, but there was obviously something more in her, something people saw and recognized in her performances and with which they identified. She had a luminous quality, a combination of wistfulness, radiance, yearning, that set her apart and made everyone wish to be a part of it. She had a luminous quality, a combination of wistfulness, radiance, yearning, to set her apart and yet make everyone wish to be a part of it, to share in the childish naivete which was so shy and yet so vibrant. This quality was even more evident when she was in the stage. I am truly sorry that the public who loved her did not have the opportunity to see her as we did, in many of the roles that foreshadowed what she would have become. Without a doubt, she would have been one of the really great actresses of the stage. Now it is at an end. I hope her death will stir sympathy and understanding for a sensitive artist and a woman who brought joy and pleasure to the world. Of his fondness for Marilyn, the revered poet Carl Sandburg, whom she had met during the filming of Some Like It Hot in 1959, wrote, "She was not the usual movie idol. There was something democratic about her. She was the type who would join in and wash up the supper dishes, even if you didn't ask her." When Marilyn died on August 4, 1962, her first husband, Jim Doherty, learned of it from his LAPD friend, Sergeant Jack Clemens. His thoughts regarding her state of affairs, as outlined in his book, portended of a Norma Jean Marilyn fighting to separate herself from those who could harm her. Norma Jean had been brought up as a young woman of discretion who trusted people. Now, for more than 10 years, she had been a glamorous movie star. Although at the very end she seemed to be shutting herself away from the jungle, possibly to try to save herself, she had been surrounded too long by those wild animals who were no doubt next to her for whatever reward they could get, her money, or just an association of being close to Marilyn Monroe. Doherty added, "Norma Jean needed love and reassurance for just being herself. From a distance, I knew she was making a real effort to change her image, to finally be accepted as a real actress."